Poetry on the Radio, poetry in and around the ACT. I'm Peter Monahan, the producer of Poetry on the Radio, here on ArtSound FM. We've reached the first anniversary of broadcasting our program. We've featured conversations with poets from around the ACT and occasionally poets visiting Canberra. To mark our anniversary, I and Poetry on the Radio co-hosts Peter Soles and Kimberly K. Williams thought we might let listeners know how we came to be interested in poetry in the first place. So we've each selected some poems that suggest why, and talked about them. Last week, Kimberly K. Williams shared some poems, and Peter Soles did too. Today, Peter Soles shares some more, and then I do.
So on to my next poem, which I actually came across through a movie. I'm very into movies, and I watched a movie recently, and it had a poem in it. It was a very bleak and depressing poem, so I didn't want to choose that for this, but I've chosen a poem by the same poet. And it's just so American, that's the thing, is it's such an American poem, and that's why I thought my voice is not going to be right for reading it, and I wanted to ask Kimberly if you might read it.
Sure. 38 Michigans by Eva H.D. You are 38 Michigans away from me, 38 Wolverine states into your cups in the sky. Because being dead is like being profoundly tanked, profound as an empty silo, with your thoughts and your arms and your credit cards ignoring you. Just eyes, eyes, and behind those eyes, nothing, or the sky, or the smell of manure, or 38 Michigans of black, bloated ice. One Michigan is bigger by far than a football field, and 2 or 10 is one of those I'm a man who needs no woman type of motorcycle trips, and 15 is all the old routes of tea or silk or spice, or the Trans-Siberian misery rolled. But 38 is the size of the space where, oh, I need to call you, though laying hands upon the phone, I'm repelled by a force field of practicality, grasping at the incongruities of the calendar year and my desire and your non-existence. 38 Michigans away, you are no doubt somewhere or other, balking at being, polishing off a sandwich made of rare, impossible air. You are as likely as the apocalypse. I can almost hear you on my radio, the cracks in your voice of clay. I summon up photos of our planet as seen from invented places like, for example, the moon, and it looks like a Rubik's Cube. Peel off the stickers and solve the black plastic beneath. Solve this blank sheet of aluminum. Solve this anteater. Yes, I recommend walking in the rain, sluicing in the lake, howling at the shadow of the moon behind the moon. Say, go long before you throw long. Say, heads, give the dead more than their due. Yes, I recommend cutting and running. Can you hear me, 38 Michigans down the line? Go long. Oh, there's so much in there.
Right.
This is why I began to use this format for the, you know, teaching, is because you end up finding poems and poets brand new.
I really just stumbled across that poem because, as I said, I'd watched this film. It's called I'm Thinking of Ending Things, and it has an Eva H.D. poem in it, and it's a very sort of postmodern film which doesn't make a lot of sense, so you got to keep thinking about what the hell it meant. And a lot of interpretations I've come across are that it really is just sort of about that poem. So I was appreciating that poem, and I just looked up who she was, and I found that this poem, 38 Michigans, it won the Montreal International Poetry Prize in 2015. So I thought that would be worth reading. And immediately, I just loved... Well, I love the modernness of it. It's about death. It links back to the previous poem I was reading about birth, and I thought that's why they sort of go together well. But in talking about something unknowable and so abstract, she's using really just everyday language and really modern language. And I just like that as a reminder of, you know, for someone who is writing poetry myself, as a sort of an approach, and how effective it can be just to bring everything back to things that are real, things that details in your everyday life, and just saying them plainly in your own voice, it has no less weight than, you know, trying to use sort of grand or floral language.
Did you find out who she is and what's her biography?
All I know is that she's from New York.
Right, and I saw quickly in the bio that she lives in Toronto. It's interesting to get from New York State, not New York City, but New York State, to Detroit. You would go through Canada and not too far from Toronto. So it's interesting to me that she's using the state as sort of a measuring distance, you know, metaphorically, right? 38 Michigans away. It's so abstract, and yet I completely get that. It's really, really neat.
So she is known to some degree because she won that prize and so forth. But, I mean, it does illustrate exactly what you're saying, Kimberly, that this exercise turns up things you wouldn't imagine.
That's exactly right. I'm going to go chase all this up when we're done.
In sixth grade, I entered the Estedford, the Canberra Estedford, at the Albert Hall poetry recitation, and I came second last. And two aspects of that I remember very well is that the person I beat was one of my classmates. He was newly arrived from Spain. He could speak barely a word of English. So I thought, really, I did come last. I was so nervous. And it was made a lot worse because the adjudicator was the poet whose poem we had to recite. It was a well-known Australian poet. And she objected that I had mispronounced one of the words. I forget the exact word, was something like horned at the end of a line, and she faulted me for not saying horned, because then that would suit the meter that she'd chosen. I thought, well, that's very strange and odd. When I was 16, I happened to be in a bookstore in London. I flipped open a book. It was a Faber Selected Poems of Wallace Stevens, and this was a poem that I opened it to. I remember it very well. Anecdote of the jar. I placed a jar in Tennessee, and round it was, upon a hill. It made the slovenly wilderness surround that hill. The wilderness rose up to it and sprawled around, no longer wild. The jar was round upon the ground, and tall, and of a port in air. It took dominion everywhere. The jar was grey and bare. It did not give of bird or bush, like nothing else in Tennessee.
That is such an unusual poem, I think, for somebody who's 16. What was it?
I don't know. It was, like you were saying, sort of that flash. There are two other poems I'll read, and the second one is sort of a manifesto, and the first one is, I guess, it illustrates what the manifesto is talking about. Sea surface full of clouds. In that November off Tehuantepec, the slopping of the sea grew still one night, and in the morning summer hued the deck and made one think of rosy chocolate and gilt umbrellas. Paradisal green gave suavity to the perplexed machine of ocean, which like limpid water lay. Who then in that ambrosial latitude, out of the light, evolved the moving blooms? Who then evolved the sea blooms from the clouds, diffusing balm in that Pacific calm? C'était mon enfant, mon bijou, mon âme. The sea clouds whitened far below the calm, and moved, as blooms move, in the swimming green and in its watery radiance, while the hue of heaven, in an antique reflection, rolled round those flotillas, and sometimes the sea poured brilliant iris on the glistening blue. In that November off Tehuantepec, the slopping of the sea grew still one night. At breakfast, jelly yellow streaked the deck, and made one think of chop-house chocolate and sham umbrellas, and a sham-like green kept summer seeming on the tense machine of ocean, which in sinister flatness lay. Who then beheld the rising of the clouds that strode submerged in that malevolent sheen? Who saw the mortal masses of the blooms of water moving on the water floor? C'était mon frère du ciel, ma vie, mon or. The gongs rang loudly as the windy booms hoo-hooed it in the darkened ocean blooms. The gongs grew still, and then the blue heaven spread its crystalline pendentives on the sea, and the macabre of the water glooms in an enormous undulation fled. In that November off Tehuantepec, the slopping of the sea grew still one night, and a pale silver patterned on the deck and made one think of porcelain chocolate and pied umbrellas. An uncertain green, piano-polished, held the trance machine of ocean as a prelude holds and holds. Who, seeing silver petals of white blooms unfolding in the water, feeling sure of the milk within the saltiest spurge, heard then the sea unfolding in the sunken clouds. O c'était mon extase, mon amour. So deeply sunken were they, that the shrouds, the shrouding shadows, made the petals black until the rolling heaven made them blue, a blue beyond the rainy hyacinth, and smiting the crevasses of the leaves, deluged the ocean with a sapphire blue. In that November off Tehuantepec, the night-long slopping of the sea grew still. A mellow morning dozed upon the deck and made one think of musky chocolate and frail umbrellas. A too fluent green suggested malice in the dry machine of ocean, pondering dank stratagem. Who then beheld the figures of the clouds, like blooms secluded in the thick marine, like blooms, like damasks that were shaken off from the loosed girdles in the spangling mast? C'était ma foi, la nonchalance divine. The nakedness would rise and suddenly turn, salt masks of beard and mouths of bellowing wood, but more suddenly the heaven rolled its bluest sea clouds in the thinking green, and the nakedness became the broadest blooms, mild mallows that a mallow sun cajoled. In that November off Tehuantepec, night stilled the slopping of the sea. The day came, bowing and voluble upon the deck. Good clown. One thought of Chinese chocolate and large umbrellas, and a motley green followed the drift of the obese machine of ocean, perfected in indolence. What pistache one, ingenious and droll, beheld the sovereign clouds as jugglery, and the sea as turquoise turban sambo, kneaded tossing saucers, cloudy conjuring sea. C'était mon esprit bâtard, l'ignominie. The sovereign clouds came clustering. The conch of loyal conjuration trumped. The wind of green blooms turning, crisp the motley hue to clearing opalescence. Then the sea and heaven rolled as one, and from the two came fresh transfigurings of freshest blue.
You know, when he altered the details, I'd see sort of a revised painting. But to me, the poem reads like paintings.
Yeah, I can see the way that we sort of interpret and react to nature, and his returning again and again to the same scene and taking different things from it. I think it's beautiful to capture that idea in a poem, because I just feel like thoughts and ideas are so fleeting. I don't know if you ever feel like this is just like you're just losing all of yourself in a way all the time, because it's just streaming and dissipating. But yeah, this poem seems to reflect on that process for me.
Yeah, no, it's extraordinary the way that he is, I guess, mastering what he sees, and it's a performance in a sense, and there's something, you know, joyful in that performance, and it acknowledges the mightiness of the ocean, and at the same time it imposes some sense of order on it that it can't in one way sustain. Mm. I mean, you can't sustain that ordering of the ocean, but he does it with this very strange, it's almost hallucinogenic in a sense, this repetition and seeing it in different ways. And it sort of acknowledges the way that the ocean is lambent. It's just moving, playing. It's ungraspable.
Mm.
So you have that tension between imagination and physical reality.
Mm.
And this sort of, this is, to me, it's such a triumphant poem in its accomplishment.
Mm.
Yeah.
As always, I'm coming back to movies, and that the way you're describing your interpretation of the poem is making me think of Solaris, a Russian sci-fi film about a planet where the ocean has the power to generate your imagination into reality, and so that the people who come around it suddenly are visited by people that they've lost, or, you know, people, just anyone that they're dreaming or thinking of. And it's sort of like haunted by it. I feel like that poem should be in that movie.
The idea of order at Key West. She sang beyond the genius of the sea. The water never formed to mind or voice, like a body, holy body, fluttering its empty sleeves. And yet its mimic motion made constant cry, caused constantly a cry that was not ours, although we understood, inhuman, of the veritable ocean. The sea was not a mask, no more was she. The song and water were not medleyed sound, even if what she sang was what she heard, since what she sang was uttered word by word. It may be that in all her phrases stirred the grinding water and the gasping wind, but it was she and not the sea we heard. For she was the maker of the song she sang. The ever-hooded, tragic-gestured sea was merely a place by which she walked to sing. Whose spirit is this, we said, because we knew it was the spirit that we sought, and knew that we should ask this often as she sang. If it was only the dark voice of the sea that rose, or even coloured by many waves, if it was only the outer voice of sky and cloud, of the sunken coral water-walled, however clear, it would have been deep air, the heaving speech of air, a summer sound repeated in a summer without end, and sound alone. But it was more than that, more even than her voice and ours, among the meaningless plungings of water and the wind, theatrical distances, bronze shadows heaped on high horizons, mountainous atmospheres of sky and sea. It was her voice that made the sky acutest at its vanishing. She measured to the hour its solitude. She was the single artificer of the world in which she sang, and when she sang, the sea, whatever self it had, became the self that was her song, for she was the maker. Then we, as we beheld her striding there alone, knew that there never was a world for her except the one she sang, and singing made. Ramon Fernandez, tell me if you know, why, when the singing ended and we turned toward the town, tell why the glassy lights, the lights in the fishing boats at anchor there, as the night descended, tilting in the air, mastered the night and portioned out the sea, fixing emblazoned zones and fiery poles, arranging, deepening, enchanting night. Oh, blessed rage for order, pale Ramon. The maker's rage to order words of the sea, words of the fragrant portals, dimly starred, and of ourselves and of our origins, in ghostlier demarcations, keener sounds.
So all the poems in the world And three, you pick three poems by Wallace Stevens. Yeah. Would you address that?
I think it's, in a sense, however varied your reading is, there's something about those first formative readings. So that poem's sort of a manifesto that is unusual for a manifesto because it actually manifests what it advocates, and as do the other two in different ways. There's many, many poets I could read, but I think I'm just sort of captivated by Wallace Stevens, so that my, yeah, I don't know. It's just, yeah, I was so captivated initially, and that hasn't ended.
It's a lifelong relationship.
Yeah. But, you know, there's, I've thought, oh, okay, well, the poems that subsequently most sort of grabbed me were, say, the simplest of Blake poems, or you know, that poem had some drama in it. Sort of, it's a dramatic monologue in a sense. And so I think of, say, Browning, those dramatic monologues there, how riveting they are, so different. But I guess it's just the craft is what really grabs me in those. And the unliteralness of it in one regard, that, I mean, Wallace Stevens is very contrived in one sense, but the contrivance makes complete sense. So there's a sort of an incantation in it.
Yeah, I think of him as a poet. He's almost ungraspable, but he's graspable enough to keep you interested in trying to grasp. And I think it's fascinating, you know, two of those poems were about water. And really, the first poem is a lot about air, right? And it's the elements that we can't grasp.
Yeah.
And from very early on, when you were first encountering Wallace Stevens, were you reading him aloud, or were you just, did that only occur to you later?
I certainly realized that you had to think of how it was said. You know, you it's that thing about, well, are you reading with your eyes or are you reading with your ears, in a sense, because, yeah, there's just something very strange of the incantation of a lot of the poems, and their literal meaning is so ungraspable in some ways. A lot of them think, well, what the hell is going on? And why is he talking about an emperor of ice cream?
Right, right.
It's all uncanny.
Right, right, right. Those are really fortuitous moments, I think. You know, I was standing in a Marble bookstore, right, when I found the Creeley poem. And I think in some ways that is the act of faith that is writing, you know, is that if you put this poem into the world, somebody somewhere someday will find it and respond to it, and you'll never know it.
Yeah, and conversely, it's the act of faith of reading. And you realize, you know, what would it be like if there weren't bookstores? Because bookstores even have a different quality than libraries. Because you know that somebody has sort of selected things, or there's a happenstance about what you come up with at a bookstore it's something different from a library.
Right. For me, the difference is quite simple. It's that, you know, the library, it's not mine. I have to return it. It's a different relationship, right? If I'm going to purchase something, right, it's a type of commitment. And, yeah.
That's the first step in book hoarding.
Yeah. You end up with a pile of books in a different country. Ultimately, you ended up living in the States for decades, right? So did living there, dwelling there, help you understand or come to his poetry in any kind of different way? Or has it just always been there?
Well, strangely, what it made me realize most was how you could be an insurance executive and a poet, which made no sense. It makes more sense once you've spent time in the US, and I'm not sure exactly why that is, but there's something about the poetry, though, that it just sort of jumps out of, off the page at you, so you can relate to it regardless of your national perspective. Like, unlike, say, Faulkner, where you almost need to spend 10 or 20 years in America before you can make sense of it, I think.
Right. No, for sure. I see what you're saying. I just wondered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he's so, in some regards, he's so removed from everyday America,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, he is.
And so he's at Key West, or he's alluding to French symbolists and so forth. And
right, or he's using French. But it's true, too. I mean, he worked in a very exclusive, right? You're an insurance executive. I don't think that many people are familiar with that work either.
It seems so sterile by comparison with his life of the imagination.
Mm. Maybe. I mean, it's kind of like my imagination, I think, was greatly formed by very long car rides through Michigan.
38 Michigan.
Yeah, 38 Michigans. It was probably two Michigans. You know, back before there was any sort of device, any handheld device, too.
Yeah, when I was stranger, he was obsessed with measurement, but it was a measurement of the metaphysical, which is just such a strange sort of undertaking, to try and measure the metaphysical.
Yeah.
So shaping it and, you know,
incredibly abstract.
Yeah, it's like studying pure mathematics or something in some regards. But the measurement fitted his career in insurance, in a sense, you know.
Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. It makes me think of the jar, right? So that insurance life, or that insurance work in his life, changed it to a certain degree. It probably tamed the wildness, right? It and forced him to look at life in a certain way and then react or respond to it differently. Yeah. You get these poems that are amazing. They are works of art, really.
And certainly what it prepared me for, it inclined me towards, was the crafted nature of the poetry that I came to like. So, like Old English seagoing poems that are incredibly wrought, and they're like an incantation too. Or Blake, or some, you know, poets like that, that where it can be, you know, 15 of the simplest words ever written, and it can be absolutely hugely expansive, magical in concept and expression.
Tiger, like tiger.
Lamb, the tiger. Yeah.
Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forest of the night. Like, poof.
Yeah, little lamb who made thee. Just like that's like a incantation. It's like, little lamb who made thee, little lamb who made thee.
I can hear my father saying those lines. That poem was in a book he used to read to us.
Well, they're, in a sense, about the awe of it, contemplating anything that exists and is created. Like it's awe, the tiger, the lamb. You know, how can they be?
That's right.
Today and on our previous episode, we, the producers of Poetry on the Radio, have marked the first anniversary of broadcast of our program by talking about how we came to be interested in poetry. Next week, our guest will be Canberra-based poet Carmel Summers. I'm Peter Monahan. Poetry on the Radio is produced each week here in the studios of Art Sound FM on unceded traditional lands in Canberra. Program co-hosts are Peter Searles and Kimberly K. Williams, who produce the program with me, Peter Monahan. Poetry on the Radio is heard Sundays at 4:30 and again Mondays at 10:30 p.m. on ArtSound FM.